So the title of my talk tonight is Buddha Wisdom. I was reading one of Ajahn Sumedho's books called The Wisdom, or The Mind and the Way, rather, and I was struck by the term that he used, Buddha Wisdom. And of course it means awakening wisdom, the wisdom that wakes us up. So that's the theme of the talk. So, of course, Buddha wisdom is the wisdom of the Four Noble Truths. The wisdom that in life there is suffering. Not all life is suffering, but that in life there is suffering. There's causes and conditions that contribute to the suffering. There is liberation, so there is freedom from it, and there is the path to the cessation of the suffering. And this path is to be cultivated, and that's what we're doing here. So the Pali word, Bud, means to wake up, and that's why the Buddha was nicknamed Buddha, the awakened one. So essentially it's wakeful wisdom, awakened wisdom. It's to look in a way and see life from the perspective of freedom. It's to look in a way that's, I often say it's a slightly different way, but actually I think it's a radically different way. It's to look and see, not from our conditioned mind, but to look and see in a way that's rather free. So rather than looking bound to our habits of mind, and our habit of mind, of course, is to think rather dualistically. It's to divide the world. It's to think as if we are a separate person, a separate sense of self. So when we look at the world from the sense of I, me and my, from a self-centered perspective, we see ourselves and the world. And in this way, we're dividing our perspective. We're separating things into two, me and the world, self and other. And of course, the more we think about ourselves and build up ourselves, the more there is this division and separation into the other. When we look in a wakeful way, when we look with the heart and mind that isn't bound to self-centeredness, when we no longer look from within the framework of the narrowness of the I perspective, when we look in a more expansive way, we begin to see that there's a way of being with everything that occurs in this life that's much more free. In fact, it's really incredibly free. So this is Buddha wisdom. It's to see in a way that is not self-centered. So the Pali word for wisdom is punya. And the nyat part of it means to know. And the first part of the word gives it a really active quality or dynamic. So when we see with wisdom, in English, wisdom is a noun. And so we have the idea that wisdom is something that we can have or acquire or get. But actually, to see with wisdom is an active process. So the kind of knowing we're talking about is the knowing or understanding, not something that we have. So we're referring, when we say wisdom, to the process of knowing or understanding, the act of knowing or understanding. Okay. So wisdom's not something that we reach or get through meditation. Sorry. But instead, it just requires this shift in the way we perceive the world. A total shift in the way we relate to the world, actually. So we can directly experience life without clinging to the whole idea and notion of I, me, and mine. This is Buddha wisdom. So panya, or wisdom, is an activity. It's not a thing. It's an ongoing process. And of course, there's an incredibly natural wisdom, a natural freedom that we can touch into. You've seen it already here in the instructions and the inquiry today. So the Buddha's known as a teacher of liberation through wisdom. This is the insight meditation tradition it requires to see into our experience and to understand the significance of it. And then every experience we have is a potential doorway to freedom. So we're particularly interested in the kind of knowing that illuminates life. It shines a light that allows us to see more clearly. So we shine the light of awareness with our mindful attention onto all the activities of the day. We shine, if you like, unreactive awareness, or awareness that isn't in reaction to things that we are encountering. And in this way, we start to live much more consciously. In this way, we're no longer responding bound to the past. Our responses aren't fueled by our conditioning based on our past experience. Much of the time, our actions and reactions are colored, and we layer upon reality our difficulties and conditioned mind and ideas that we have, the way we see ourselves, if you like. We add that through imagination, through memory, through fear, through anxiety, through worry. We add all of that to the actuality of our experience. We very rarely actually see life just as it is, just as it's come to be. Instead, we add another layer, and that obscures our clear seeing. Ajahn Sumedho says, to realize the unconditioned, we have to let go of our constant attachment to conditioned phenomena. So, of course, our natural response of the mind is to grasp and cling and to hold to conditioned phenomena. And here, in our practice, we're discovering the reality of non-grasping. We're discovering how to be with our sensations, our feelings, our thoughts, our perceptions, and with consciousness without grasping. The practice is utterly and totally one of non-grasping. It's the key ingredient in Dharma practice. It's to learn to let be, to let go, to relinquish and soften the clinging. Otherwise, we just shift from one conditioned position to another, expecting a different result. And yet, we are caught then in that which is unsatisfactory, and we suffer. So the minute we cling to something, we're in trouble. There's difficulty, there's sorrow, there's anguish, there's despair, there's anxiety. We're no longer free. What we tend to do is try to modify and adjust the self rather than to totally see in and through and to see how the self is constructed. And the invitation, of course, is to really see how we construct the self and to let that go. And sometimes there are events in the world where we can be really incredibly touched. And one of these stories, I think it's from about 2018, some time ago now, anyway, occurred. Oh, they can't hear? Just up a little bit if you could. One of these stories involved the Thai children, the Thai soccer team, who went on an adventure with their coach one day, and they went into a cave, and the cave was very, very long, and unfortunately, while they were in there, I think they went about 6 miles, or about 10 kilometers, underground through all these winding passages. And while they were in there, of course, the rains and they were flooded, the passageways in were all flooded, and these young children, I think they were counting the coach, there were 13 people altogether, were stuck inside. It was 9 days before they were found. You can imagine the distress of the parents during this time and all the people who knew that the children were there. And in Australia, of course, one of the, it's a happy ending story, one of the people who rescued them is an Australian doctor called Dr. Richard Harris. And he, in and of himself, is just a remarkable human being, I thought. He was a cave diver himself. And I can't think of anything worse myself than being underwater in a cave where you can't see a thing. All you can do is kind of follow along. And, I mean, sometimes you can see. Sometimes there are beautiful underwater scenes and crystal clear water. But a lot of the time the water is totally muddy. And so these divers dive through, and they dive through really narrow spaces where they have to squeeze through with their oxygen tank. And I can't imagine getting stuck in one of those caves. So it's not my thing. But not my thing at all, I tell you. However, these divers, after 9 days, found these children and their soccer coach, and they were all alive. And they were sitting on a little ledge far into the mountainside. And then, of course, the issue was how to get them out. And it's incredibly symbolic, because it's kind of, they came from the darkness into the light. They came from an utterly, seemingly hopeless situation where it was really feared that they would die, out. They were rescued, and so they were brought out into the light again. It was extraordinary. So it's one of those stories from imminent death to survival, from the darkness to the light, from danger to safety. So the divers who found them and then took them food, and a whole lot of Thai, several Thai divers stayed with the children and didn't leave them alone once they'd found them. Those people were just so extraordinarily selfless. This is, you know, it's one of the situations like this bring out the very best qualities of the human heart, where many, many people are prepared to do dangerous things in order to save another. It's extraordinary. So many people contributed to the eventual rescue of the children. The doctor, who was the cave diver, was also an anaesthetist. Everybody know what that is? An anaesthetist, someone who... So it was decided, after much discussion, that the only possible way to get the children out was to put them to sleep, inject them with a drug, which made them unconscious. And so the doctor said it felt so utterly wrong that his whole training was to save life, and what he needed to do was to put each child in a wetsuit, inject them with the drug, and then push them underwater to make sure that no water went inside the wetsuit. He said it was contrary and counter to everything he'd ever learned about being a doctor. And so it was a very difficult process for him to do. But without that, there was absolutely no hope. These children would have just starved and died. And one of the reasons I'm telling the story is that the soccer coach was a former monk. And so the way they survived for the 9 days was he taught the children to meditate. This is mindful meditation. Okay? You think it's tough here? Just remember those children. Just imagine. You're 6 kilometers underground. You can't get out. You're starving. You haven't eaten for 9 days. And the whole place smells disgusting. And there you are, mindfully meditating, keeping the mind calm, not going into panic. So this is what happened. So Dr. Richard Harris, he said he was wonderful when he was interviewed. He didn't see himself as a hero at all. He just said, I did what I needed to do under the circumstances. So there were circumstances that contributed to the whole thing, the rain. Many other things had been tried. They tried to pump out the water. They couldn't. Many people helped. Divers had come from many different nations all around the world. Engineers had come to try and pump the water out. Thai farmers had very happily had their rice crops flooded in hoping that that would mean that the children could be rescued. So many, many people cooperated. Many people came together. Thai people fed hundreds of people while this whole rescue was in place. It was the most extraordinary situation of cooperation, international cooperation. And so I thought about it. I thought, how come? What made this a situation? There's so many situations around the world where international cooperation and love and care and understanding could bring about good, could really change things. So in this situation, I think some of the contributing factors were the innocence of the children. Haven't we all done things like that were dangerous, where we could have died as a child? I know I certainly did. And so the innocence of the children, I think, is what brought about this a huge worldwide response of compassion and love. So I was deeply touched by the whole thing, and I was very deeply touched by this doctor who put aside his own kind of feelings of, because he was quite troubled about doing it. In fact, on the very first day, they managed to get three children out. It was a very complex process, taking children kilometers through narrow passageways like this. And there was one place where they could only barely get through. They actually had to take the oxygen bottle off the child and pass the child to somebody else the other side. The passageway was so narrow. So I can't imagine how distressing this was. And when the doctor, at the end of the day, utterly exhausted, came out, he looked at somebody and they said, 3 out of 3. Or 4 out of 4, I can't remember which. And he immediately thought that all four had died. And then they said, no, no, all four had lived. And so he said he went home completely exhausted and then needed to go back and do it all over again the next day. And I think it took them 3 or 4 days to get all 13 out. And all 13 lived. It's just a beautiful story. And the reason I love it is that people put their self-centeredness aside and really acted with selfless compassion. And it was extraordinary. I remember I was completely gripped to the television set watching the whole thing, because in Australia it was broadcast live to air because our doctors were there attempting this rescue. So in situations like this, the best qualities of the human heart, of compassion, cooperation, selflessness, come forward. And we all have those qualities. When we understand that the self is not so important, there's something else that moves us, something else that moves and informs the actions that we take. And these are noble actions. It was an extraordinary thing to be involved in and to be able to bring about the rescue of those children. And, of course, one man, one Thai Navy diver died doing it. He ran out of oxygen. So Buddha wisdom lets us see in a way that's not bound to desire or to the mind that runs in pursuit of things. So our wisdom lets us see our grief, our sorrow, our loss, and also the heart of divine joy all at once sometimes. So in the midst of the very devastating situations, we can sometimes see through, we can sometimes move through it. We can sometimes see and know an extraordinary love that can't be lost. It's a kind of knowing of that which can never leave us. And here I want to talk about another heroine of mine, really. She has just become so. A couple of days ago, in between retreats, I watched an Australian documentary, and it was about a woman called Gina Chick. She's an Australian woman who's already had a remarkable life. She was recently on one of those reality TV shows, which I didn't watch, I didn't even know it was on. It's called Alone Australia. And what they do is they take 10 people into the wilderness, and they took them into a forest in Tasmania, which is in, you know, the island off the bottom of Australia, which is the coldest and wettest place in the whole country. They took them there in midwinter. They could take 10 things with them, and the idea was that they had to survive in the wild. Now, this woman had a quite extraordinary childhood. She was really brought up in nature where she could romp and play and run free. And she said she was a rather strange child. She loved birds and animals, and she often took a lizard in her pocket to school and would feed it with an eyedropper, and she would look after wounded birds, and she would chew up food for them and let the birds eat from her tongue and so on. So, of course, she was teased mercilessly at school for all of this behaviour. But as she grew older, she began to explore indigenous ways of surviving in the wild, and she went to America and learned from the American Indians how to hunt and gather and survive in the wild, and then also from our own indigenous people in Australia. She learned to be in nature without any fear. And she and her husband began they called them rewilding retreats, where they have people who come and they put them in nature and they have to survive. That's a bit tough. They don't have meals like we have here. In fact, she does this process with women where they come for 2 days and they fast the whole time. They have a tarp, a tarpaulin in case it rains, and I think they have something to light a fire, and then nothing else. And so for 2 days, they need to be with themselves. No books, no phones, no nothing, just touching in. So it's rather similar to being on retreat. So anyway, she was doing all of this, the rewilding programs with her husband, and then she applied at 52 years old to be part of this, survivor reality TV program. She ended up winning. She won it after surviving 67 days alone. That in itself is quite extraordinary. But what is more extraordinary about her is her life prior to that. And so this is why I'm telling the story. When she was in America, studying with the Native Americans and learning their ways, she, at 39 years old, met a 26-year-old man. They fell in love and were married. She thought she couldn't have children, but at 40, she discovered she was pregnant. He was completely delighted, and she was utterly surprised. So it was a wonderful bit of news for them. They were having a child. Her husband had always wanted to have children. However, partway through the pregnancy, she discovered a lump in her breast. And so she was diagnosed with cancer and needed to have chemotherapy. She said at first she was told she would have to terminate the pregnancy, but her wild warrior mother said no way. So during the pregnancy, she had the chemotherapy, and the baby was born, and the baby was completely and utterly fine, and they were delighted. And there's all these beautiful photographs of them. However, the story goes on. Just before the child was 3, she also was diagnosed with a lump in her stomach, and which turned out to be cancer. And very sadly, at 3 years old, her daughter, Blaze, died. And she talks about the grief that she felt. And the way that she talks about it is so extraordinary. I want to read you what she said, some of what she said. She says, "Life has taught me over and over to die to every moment, which means letting go. There is such freedom in that. It means I meet each moment with wonder, excited to see what's in store, I'm not thinking about tomorrow or even yesterday or what might have been. To me, that's pointless. She said, dancing with grief over the past decade, because it's a decade since her daughter died, has taught me how to be with what is rather than what I wish could be or should be. It's profound wisdom. This is the wisdom of the Dharma, actually. And so amid her grief, she said she howled at the sky and wailed and did all kinds of things, but she said she has come to terms with her grief and her loss. And she says about her daughter, everything I am now is because of her. This has me shaking my head in wonder at the perfection of life. I have dived to the very core of my being, and I'm not afraid of any feeling, because I know there is nothing that cannot be born, nothing that we cannot bear, that means. Journeys into inner and outer wilderness, touching the void, listening to Mama Gaia, that means Mother Earth, all makes sense when those elements have held me through the darkest days. I know that every single living thing is part of the same thing. I'll say that again. I know that every single living thing is part of the same thing. We all are. This is home. Not as a New Age concept, but as a visceral lived truth. So it's extraordinary. Through her grief, she's found release from the grief. She's seen that the way to live is to die to every moment, to die to the past, to die to the pleasant, to die to the unpleasant, to be fully and utterly with life as it's come to be. This is Dharma wisdom. I have no idea if she's ever heard of the Dharma, but this is just natural wisdom. So sometimes through our grief, we can have extraordinary understandings, an extraordinary depth of not only wisdom, but freedom itself can come forth. So coming back to the Buddha's teachings, the radical liberation the Buddha taught involves stepping out of the cycle of conditioned reality. So we see the appearance of the world, but we also turn our attention to that which is not of appearances. We see all that arises and ceases. We see all that comes and goes, but we also get a whisper of that which can never be lost, a whisper of the freedom that Gina Chick is talking about, a whisper of the knowing that we can be utterly comfortable with life, with all of its differences, with everything that we face. We can touch into and know an extraordinary sense of freedom. So we are instructed, in order to do this, we're instructed by the Buddha to just see. When hearing, just hear. When smelling an odor, just smell it. When experiencing a tactile, that's a felt sensation, just feel it. And when thinking about something, just be aware. So when we do it just like that, this is non-dual wisdom, if you like. It means that the functions of the body, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking, are not contaminated, if you like, by the self-view. We're not attaching to the self to the direct experience. We're just seeing with things as they are, being with life as it is. So when this notion or this belief we have of self-identity begins to dissolve and fade, we then touch extraordinary freedom. Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of the great teachers in Thailand, said, "All things are nothing but a perpetual flowing. That is, they are empty of a definitive self. All things are anicca, so all things are also impermanent. They change incessantly. They flow on endlessly. That perpetual flux, or shift or change, is devoid of any self or anything belonging to a self." So we are invited to see our body, our feelings, our perceptions, our thoughts, our ideas, our emotions, our consciousness as not me, not mine, not who I am, but rather simply part of organic life. And then we are held by this living universe. We are held by nature itself. We're part of it, not separate from it. And that knowing, that deep understanding, brings release. The Dalai Lama points out something rather important about this. He says, the self, as a convention, needs not to be negated. So we're not trying to destroy the self. We can still say you and me, and we know what we mean. He says, only the self that's being grasped at as intrinsically real needs to be negated. And so we need to understand that. Otherwise, we get totally confused by the whole notion of not self. So the meditator's method of discovering freedom is to be with our direct experience, to see where there's a sensation in the body. We bring tender, loving attention to that sensation. If it's a contraction, we bring our attention to it. We see if we can dissolve the contraction or the tightness within the heart. That's often where it is, but it can be in many other places. We track and we see the shifting, changing sensation. And then what we do is we bring some inquiry to it. We ask, is there a belief that's associated with this sensation, this pain in the body, this area of the body? And very often what comes is there's a thought formation or a belief or an idea or a concept we have that's keeping the pain in place. It's fueling the emotion. And the classic one-line thoughts that fuel our suffering are things like, I'm unlovable, or I'm unworthy, I'm inadequate, or other thought formations are things like, I'm right, or I know best, and so on. We have to see that these are simply thought formations. They're ideas, they're concepts. Or put together. And then we touch more deeply into that which is not bound anywhere, not bound to the world of thought. So our natural wisdom lets us see in a way that's not self-centered. One of the ways that we can work with the thoughts that arise in the mind is to see that the conditions of the mind, if the mind's caught up in greed or the mind's agitated or the mind's negative today, is we simply let the conditions of the mind cease. With our awareness, what's revealed is the state of mind today, how we're feeling today, whether the mind is caught up or free, or sometimes the mind is clear, sometimes it's cloudy, sometimes the mind is quite elevated and high, sometimes it's rather dull. We simply see what's the condition of the mind, and then we bring awareness to it, and we don't cling to it and claim, this is me, this is mine, this is who I am. But rather, we let the conditions of the mind cease. Every thought we have ever had comes to an end. And so we have to look, we don't have to, but we can. We can look in this way. This is the teaching. It's to see that the thoughts that we have are not me, not mine, not who I am. What a liberation that is. Because our thoughts are just thoughts. Thoughts are empty. They're invisible. They arise and cease, arise and cease. There's just so many of them. And our Buddha wisdom is to know that there is nothing worth clinging to, not even our precious, exquisite, beautiful meditation experiences. And on this note, I'll read you something that Ajahn Sumedho wrote. He was reflecting on his early years as a monk. He's an American monk in his 80s now. And can't hear? Yeah, thank you. Can you hear now? He's an American monk in his 80s, and he's deeply wise. He was a student at Ajahn Chah's monastery in Thailand, so he's part of the Thai forest tradition. And he talks about his first year of practice and then what happened afterwards. He said that in his first year, he experienced lots of blissful states. And I can hear you saying, oh, well, that doesn't happen to me. Or I wish that would happen to me. This is what he says, so listen up. He says, I'd see lights. I'd feel full of bliss as I meditated. My interpretation of these experiences was that I had attained something. I remember... Okay. I remember thinking one time that I was a completely enlightened being, and I thought, well, that didn't take very long. You know what's coming, don't you? I thought it was going to take years of hard work, but only a few months in a monastery, and here I am, perfectly enlightened, he says. After that period, in an isolated monastery, I had to go to Bangkok. Traveling on the train and arriving in Bangkok, I found that the enlightenment had totally collapsed. That there was a terribly confused American wandering around Bangkok. He said that was a great disappointment. I was expecting to radiate light all over Bangkok. But instead, I was radiating something else that wasn't very nice. He said, the following year, I went to Ajahn Chah's monastery. So he went to his teacher's monastery. And I told him about these experiences. And he just kept saying, well, you know, it's attachment. Don't attach. So don't attach even to the blissful and beautiful experiences. And so I began to realize that I was very attached to those ecstatic experiences. I could see myself always trying to get to those states again. You heard it today. I thought that the experience of bliss was what I wanted. I remembered that first year. And all those wonderful visions and experiences. And the second year, I didn't get anything at all. Don't all go home, will you? It was just pain and depression and despair, he says. He says, I do ascetic practices, so really tough practices, all the things that I remember doing in the first year, but it wouldn't work anymore. In fact, what I had to do was just to let go of remembering. So if we have a beautiful experience, if we have a heart-opening experience, of course the natural thing is to cling to it, to want it to stay. Or we might hear about somebody else's heart-opening experience and we want that. So we need to let go of remembering what our experience was. So we're letting go of the remembering, but we're not letting go of the actual wisdom from the experience. So an experience arises and ends, begins and ends. Any experience does. What stays with us is the wisdom from the experience. So this is why it's so important, even when we have fleeting, small, tiny, blissful experiences, to tease out the wisdom from them. The Buddha called it squeezing out the honey. So to really know what the significance of the experience is. So in the instructions in the morning, part of what I'm doing is trying to enable people to see the depth of understanding that comes from the experience, even if it's short and brief. If we can access calm, that tells us we can live with peace. As simple as that. If we're with our pain and the pain we see ends, subsides, what we discover, the wisdom of that, is the understanding of impermanence. If we let go and we have a sense of release and a falling into peace or freedom, we discover the wisdom of letting go. So the Dharma teachings are the teachings, but they are to be applied completely and utterly to our direct experience. And then we understand for ourselves the wisdom of the way. Then we understand for ourselves the Buddha wisdom. Part of our suffering that comes up over and over again arises because we tend to cling to that which is impermanent and want it to stay. We want to cling to the blissful experience and we want it to stay. We want to cling to a partner who's left us and we want them back again. We want to cling to someone whose life has ended and we want them back. So part of our struggle as human beings is to really see clearly the wisdom of non-clinging and to understand deeply that all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. So conditioned phenomena are everything you can see, think of, every feeling, every thought is conditioned. So you might say, well, what then is the unconditioned? So the teachings are pointing to the knowing of that which is not bound to or caught up in the conditions of life. The Buddha says this. He says, there is the unborn, uncreated, and unconditioned. Were there not the unborn, uncreated, and unconditioned, there would be no release for the born, created, and conditioned. Since there is the unborn, uncreated, and unconditioned, so there is release. Okay. We see that all conditioned phenomena are impermanent. Everything that's born dies. This is to see in terms of relative truth. We see this But we also see and know and experience a deeper Dharma. This deeper knowing of the freedom that I've been pointing to. We get a sense that all conditioned phenomena arise and cease, yet our awareness reveals that which is unborn, undying, unbound, not caught anywhere. And it's a deep and extraordinary knowing that is to be realized. So the third noble truth, there is liberation, is to be realized. It's directly understood through practice. We see conditioned phenomena arising and ceasing. We have a sense of that which is not bound to that. We have a sense of that which is unborn, undying, unwavering, unshakable. There's a beautiful verse from the Buddha. All conditioned things are impermanent. They are phenomena subject to birth and death. When birth and death no longer are, the complete silencing is joy. So the last two lines, he's talking in terms of ultimate truth, where we say, no birth, no death. The complete silencing is joy. The silencing is the silencing of all constructs, the silencing of all ideas. So the teachings point to the inconceivable, the unconditioned. And then, of course, we see that there is truth. The truth is known relatively through seeing into dependent arising, so seeing how life unfolds without clinging. It's known ultimately when we get this sense of this extraordinary depth and way of being that we can touch. Yet the two are not separate. The conditioned and the unconditioned are not separate. Once we have this sense of the breakthrough to the knowing of the unconditioned, that which isn't bound anywhere, we really see that there is the freedom amid our daily life. The freedom is known, the release is found, amid our difficulties, amid our joys. And finally, a poem from Kabir. Sometimes the poets say it best. The distinction of the conditioned from the unconditioned is but a word. The unconditioned is the seed. The conditioned is the flower and the fruit. Knowledge is the branch and the name is the root. Look and see where the root is. Happiness shall be yours when you come to the root. So he's saying come to the root of things, the very depth of things. The root will lead you to the branch, the leaf, the flower and the fruit. It's the attainment of bliss. It's the reconciliation of the conditioned and the unconditioned. So our freedom is found amid life. The two perspectives or the two ways of looking are simply ways of looking. And when freedom is known, freedom is everywhere. Let's just sit for a moment.